This week on Texas Scorecard Radio and our news, we do a roundup with the Capitol Bureau and talk about what races are developing here in Texas, from U.S. Senate all the way down to the State House. For our interview, we're joined by State Senator Bob Hall with more disturbing details out of the Pardo case, where CPS illegally seized a child in North Texas, and what you can do about it. And we'll close out with a commentary from Jordan Clements about UT's newest policy giving out special privileges, and in this case, to illegal immigrants. Coming to you from the 1836 studios in Austin, Texas, this is Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald. You can find us on the web at www.texasscorecard.com. You can follow me on social media, on Twitter, if you'd like. I'm at TweetTonyMac. Sometimes have some things to say there. Speaking of somebody who has things to say, I've got Brandon Waltons, Capitol Bureau Chief for Texas Scorecard. And we do this. You know, every couple of years in the summer, people are going, elections. There was just an election. There are elections. They're coming. And now's the time where the campaigns are getting organized. And we're getting a little bit of a vision of that, looking at who's filing, who's running, looking at some of the campaign finance reports, and talk about why that matters in a moment. But let's start at the top. Let's kind of start at the top of the ticket. Senate.
Yeah, well, I mean, it really feels different this cycle, particularly, I think, because normally in Texas, we're so used to looking at the Republican side of things that you've actually got some interesting races starting to shape up on the Democrat side.
Yeah, Democrats making a huge play for Texas, and that means competition.
Exactly, and it means Democrat voters voting in the Democrat primary, which will be important as well. But you look at the big races that we're going to have on that ballot in November 2020, so not only do you have the clown car of presidential candidates, candidates on the Democrat side, but on the U.S. Senate side, it's starting to shape up to be a crowded field. I mean, already you have MJ Hager, who was a former congressional candidate in 2018 and lost.
Failed candidate, but, you know, had a good organization.
Absolutely, and loved by Hollywood, it would seem, which is a plus, I suppose, for Democrats. You've also got Houston City Councilwoman Amanda Edwards, who's announced. You've got Chris Bell, who's a former congressman.
Ran for governor.
Well, yes. And you've got, I think, the front runner right now we're starting to see as a new announcement by State Senator Royce West out of Dallas, a guy who's been in the state Senate for 25 plus years, big institution on the Democrat side, and coming in with a lot of support from his fellow lawmakers in the Texas Senate and in the Texas House. So right now he looks like he's going to be the candidate for Democrats to beat.
Yeah, and so lots of candidates there competing to take on Senator Cornyn. Stepping over to the other chamber of Congress, there are some congressional races heating up, including a big one in Central Texas.
Yes, and this one involves maybe a familiar name. It's been a few years since we've really talked about her, I think, but Wendy Davis.
Oh, Wendy, yeah. Yes. Okay.
Remember her? Yeah. A former failed gubernatorial candidate, lost in a really spectacular fashion to then Attorney General Greg Abbott for the governor, but was a former state senator as well, a big-time pro-abortion activist now. She's announced that she's going to run for Congress, and not only is she going to run for Congress, but she's running against a freshman congressman who's been, I think, a big icon for conservatives in Texas to look to, at least in his freshman session this last year or two, and that is Chip Roy.
Yeah, so Chip Roy, kind of one of the only guys really making a name for himself in Washington, shaking things up, doing some things, forcing votes.
Yeah, coming in, forcing votes, someone who's not well-liked already by the establishment, which is generally, I think, a positive sign for taxpayers who look at that. But somebody who's come in and who's really been kind of a conservative leader. And so it'll be a very interesting contrast if she does indeed make it through a Democrat primary and make it to that November election. It will be very interesting to watch that race.
Yeah, see if people want that kind of rabble-rousing out of their congressman, or do they want a pro-abortion activist, I guess.
We'll see.
Let's talk about the Texas House of Representatives. We've talked a little bit on this program about redistricting coming up. A big part of that is the race and the fight for the Texas House. And we've got the campaign finance reports out now, so we can kind of see how those races are starting to shape and form up.
A little bit,
And again, and people go, campaign finance reports, why do I care? Big snooze. news. No, no, no. This tells you what campaigns are getting organized, right? Because in the money that wins, it's the campaigns that can raise the money that win.
Yes.
So let's talk about that.
And you're seeing some Democrats, by the way, some of these new Democrats, a couple of them coming in with pretty large war chests. You've got a race up in Dallas that looks like it'll be interesting, where you've got John Turner, who took over a seat there in the Dallas area, running against a Republican, both of them reporting six figures in their campaign finance reports. So that looks like it'll be interesting. But actually what you see most of, especially with these new Democrats who took over formerly Republican-held seats in the state House, who are going to be up for re-election again, is that a lot of them have not raised very much. I mean, you look, just one example, Aaron Zwiener, who holds a seat in Central Texas, just south of Austin. She took a seat from a Republican 2 years ago, only has less than $30,000 in her account, already has a Republican challenger with more than six figures.
Yeah, so you're seeing some opportunity in these races for folks to get engaged, mm-hmm. and say, hey, we want to take these seats back from the Democrats. And you take them back, well, then even if they pick up something else, you know, then they don't take control of Texas.
Absolutely.
Thanks for that, Brandon. We'll definitely keep an eye on it headed into the fall.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, over the last few weeks, we've been talking about the Pardo family and a real miscarriage of justice that's going on in Kaufman County here in Texas, with a child being seized from their family without evidence. We've got State Senator Bob Hall, a state senator from Senate District 2, on the line joining us. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you, Tony, for having me. It's a real honor to be on the show with you.
Well, you know, Senator Hall, you've been doing a series of commentaries up at texasscorecard.com, really informative stuff. I would say to listeners who are interested in this issue, go check those articles out. I mean, even though we're going to have an extended conversation here, you get into even more detail there in those written articles. But you have been following this along and playing the role of a leader there in your community. This is in your area, and following along, it is really, truly shocking. We had Jeremy Newman with Texas Homeschool Coalition on a few weeks ago to talk about this, but even since then, the more I've read what you've written about it, we really have a huge problem in the judicial system with regard to this case, and I think there's a lot to learn about things that can go wrong with CPS and with the government process of taking children away, and I think we definitely talk about some solutions in the legislative process. But for people out there who don't know, maybe you can give us an overview. What's going on here with the Pardo family?
Well, what's going on here is that the heart of it is the one question that CPS doesn't seem to be able to get a good handle on, which is key to their operation, and that is, when should they take a child from a home?
Right.
And we have the problem of CPS, it's been this way for almost forever, either taking them when they shouldn't or not taking them when they should.
Right.
And they don't seem to be able to figure out when to do this. And the Pardo case is one that I think is particularly egregious for a multitude of reasons that touches on everybody who had anything to do with the case.
Yeah. Let's kind of go unpack that just a little bit. We have a process in place where if a child is at, you know, imminent risk of harm, they can be taken from their parents by the state. And I think people generally think, okay, some process for that is necessary. There are cases where, you know, we need to protect a child from imminent harm. And that process is basically being abused in this case, where you have differences of opinion about medical treatment, or maybe not even differences of opinion, maybe just bureaucratic momentum. But let's move on. Let's talk about this. What's going on here? What are they doing to the Pardoe family?
Well, they're destroying the family is what they're doing, and there was no real due process in terms of following rules and generally accepted good practices, because no one in the whole process, from CPS to the courts to the doctor's office to the CASA folks, ever saw or talked to the child or the family before they took the child.
That's an extraordinary thing. So what we have here is the state has taken away a 4-year-old child from their family. The family's fighting to get the child back. You're telling me that no one involved in that decision making has ever met the family?
No, absolutely. We had as I understand from the proceedings in the court and others that have followed it. It started when a doctor at Children's Hospital made a partial review of some medical records and raised a question about the treatment, the diagnosis and treatment that doctors had made. Now, it's interesting, when I read the affidavit this doctor put together, all of her concerns were focused on the doctor's diagnosis and treatments in there, because the mother never treated the child. I mean, including brain surgery that would have been accomplished a year or so or more before that. And yet the parents are the one who are bearing the burden of having so-called done unnecessary medical services. And my question is, if their doctor was really concerned about that, did that get reported to the medical board for malpractice?
Right. That's part of it. So the theory of the case, and again, if you can say that there is any theory here other than, to me, it seems like it's really more bureaucratic momentum, is you have a doctor who files a complaint with CPS, and their theory is, well, this mother is being overly aggressive and persuading doctors to do treatment that the child doesn't need. And you go, wait a second, these are licensed doctors who are treating this child. How can the patient's child, you know, parent be responsible if the doctors then are the ones going, oh, well, yeah, and medically I'm agreeing to do this stuff?
Oh, absolutely, and that's a whole issue yet to be addressed. But you've actually raised this to indicated a level there that it never reached. The doctor did not issue a complaint. The doctor simply, and she made a point of this during her testimony, that she just had a concern and wanted to have an evaluation of the child. Well, they did that. They finally had a meeting, and what she was saying, she wanted to meet and talk with the parents about it, and so she did. They took the child in June, and then on I believe it was about the 27th of June, the doctor met with the parents and with the attorneys, and several people were at the meeting or on the phone. And at the conclusion of that meeting, the doctor said her concerns had been answered, and yet they still proceeded to go through with this taking of the keeping of the child. Holding this, what I would call a mock trial, that is obvious the decision had been made before the thing even started, because at the close of it, the judge said something to the effect, and I can't, it's not an exact quote, but it's really close, and we'll see if it's in the transcript or not. He looked at the parents and said, you know, all of this could have been avoided if you had just cooperated with CPS. That's a strong message to be delivering that said, you know, I just, you know, last 6 hours I saw no evidence of any wrongdoing. But because you didn't cooperate with a government agency that was going to take your child, I'm going to punish you and the child by terminating your parental rights because you didn't cooperate.
That's really shocking because, you know, our entire system is you don't have to cooperate when the government's trying to do something to you. You don't have to cooperate, and in fact, every lawyer out there would tell you fight like hell, you know, to defend your rights and defend your child's rights. But let's go into this with the judge. I mean, and that's something you've written about in these commentaries. So we've, you know, okay, we've got CPS and they've come in like an attack dog. But what's going on with this judge that, you know, you have this hearing that sounds like, you know, I'm an attorney. People who aren't attorneys don't necessarily understand, look, rules of hearsay and speculation and all the objections that can be had to evidence. But it sounds like everything that was being done was based off of speculation and hearsay. And the judge just allowed it. And then again, you know, reached it. It sounds like he reached a decision based off of a complete different attitude of, well, you should have cooperated. If I'll take away any child from any family who doesn't cooperate. Tell me more about this hearing. You were at the hearing, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I was there, sat on the second row, and, it was, as it proceeded, I will say one thing, the family did not have good representation, because I'm not an attorney, but, I saw things that I thought, gee, you know, you need to follow up with a question. They just opened the door for you. You need to follow up on it. And one in particular line of questioning was asking the CPS worker, you know, what constituted an emergency? That's what this was all about. This was an emergency extraction. Absolutely had to be done. The child's life was imminently in danger.
And that's the only, only an emergency can justify this type of procedure.
Yeah. And there are emergencies. There's no question about that. There are some. But in almost an hour's worth of questioning, at least it seemed like that long, of each step of the way, the attorney was asking the CPS worker, did this constitute an emergency? And each time she said no. But the interesting thing was when he'd asked the question, the CPS worker would look down at the papers she had in front of her, kind of shuffle through them, and then look up at the CPS attorney, who would be nodding her head either left or right or up or down to indicate your answer should be yes or no to the question. And this went on question after question after question. And watched, the judge was watching it. He saw it. The defense attorney never questioned it, but it went on.
So the defense, the family's attorney didn't object to it, the judge just allowed it to happen in plain sight.
That's correct. But the interesting thing was they never established a reason for it to be an emergency. Nothing ever was stated that made it an emergency. And nothing was ever testified that anything had actually been done that was harmful, that any harm had been done by either parent to the child. The closest it came was the concern expressed by the doctor that something might happen in the future.
That they might make medical decisions, or basically that they might go to a doctor and ask for medical treatment to be done that doesn't need to be done by one doctor's opinion, and that the other doctor would agree to it, and then there would be medical treatment that shouldn't happening. That's the case.
And even if that was the possibility, how does that rise to the level of an emergency?
Right. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Okay. What we have established here, and it's very clear, and again, if people want more details, I mean, we can't even do it justice. Great articles up, TexasScorecard.com, breaking down all of these events. What I want to talk about are some solutions. What are some answers to that you can be doing, or that other people's leaders and elected representatives can be doing. So first of all, two things. What can we do about this judge? Okay, is, you know, there are methods of holding the judges accountable when they just ignore and abuse the law. And second, what can you and other senators and representatives be doing in the legislature to try and make sure this doesn't happen in the future?
Well, you know, the judge, I'm going to pass on that one, because I think that's for somebody else to pick up and take on as an issue. I think it's certainly something that's worthy looking into.
Well, impeachment and removal, I don't want to nail you down too hard on it. Impeachment and removal are legislative functions. I mean, that is something that you have to consider as a senator.
Yes, I mean that's a possible, that certainly would be a consideration. Hopefully, maybe he won't run again, but But in the meantime, I do think that somebody, if the doctor that started this whole thing is serious about her questioning, and I think it's a lot of professional jealousy. There are professional doctors, you know, one knows more than the other. But if she's serious, she ought to be turning those doctors in to the medical board for an investigation.
Right.
I think she's remiss. She's remiss in her responsibilities if she seriously believes that those were unnecessary medical procedures that were being given to that child. Then those doctors that did those procedures should be held accountable for.
In fact, and that's the only people, you know, because a patient, a parent goes to a doctor, they get advice. I mean, it's the doctor who would be responsible if there was some abuse happening in that transaction.
And as a secondary concern, I think you will find that every one of those doctors and the hospital were paid with taxpayer money to do that job.
Absolutely.
It was taxpayer money that was used to do it.
Let's talk, Helen. So let's get to the legislative solutions.
Yep.
What can you, as a senator, be doing? What can people be asking their representatives and senators to do in the next session? You're in a 4-year term, so you'll be back next term. You're not up for reelection this time. You got at least two more years. What can you be doing? What can other representatives be doing to fix this problem?
Well, you know, we actually had legislation that was in the system this last session that was sponsored by a very good representative, good friend, James Frank, in District 69. He had HB 3331 and he had HB 2764, two really good bills that would have brought some really strong reforms to the CPS system. Each one of them. One of them, 2764, had to do with limiting the training so that we can get more qualified people out there to help with the children. We find that CPS is overburdened with some rather extensive, more than doubling the basic number of hours, and discouraging families from wanting to get into the system. But to the other one, the 3331, called the Child Trauma Prevention Act, I will be very supportive of James. Unfortunately, it didn't even get out of the House over there of this. But it. So
the answer there is people need to be talking to their state representatives saying, hey, this legislation that was, and it was, you know, moving to one degree or another last session, but obviously hit a roadblock on the House side.
Right.
They need to be asking them where they stand on that particular bill and that particular issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it had about 10 major points in it, all of which are designed to have a, I'm not going to say raise the bar, but have a more clearly set bar on where to go to find child abuse. And it would be things like, you know, eliminating from investigation everyday normal activities that children, of like children playing outside. I mean, people get reported for letting their children play outside, next thing you know. And part of the problem we have with these workers going after this low-hanging fruit out there of charges contributes to this so-called overload in casework. They have got cases that should never be cases in the first place.
And then that's a distraction. That's a distraction from the real cases,
right,
where they ought to be actually doing something.
Yeah, there are real cases out there. There are real problems with drug addicts and drug dealers with kids that those kids do need protection, and we do need an effective CPS out there, but actually going after children that need to be protected, not the vendetta of a CPS caseworker gets their nose out of joint.
Yeah, not somebody. They're basically
harshly.
They're basically substituting their judgment as if they are the parents.
Right.
We're running out of time. I'll tell listeners out there, absolutely go to TexasScorecard.com. Check out Senator Hall's columns. There, lots of information about these cases and the reforms. Senator Hall, real quickly, if people need to connect with you in your office, how can they reach you?
The office number is 512-463-0102. They can also go to our Facebook page at Senator Bob Hall. The articles are referenced in there, and they're also on our website, which is SenatorBobHall.com.
Great. Well, I appreciate you coming on, and I appreciate you, more importantly, the role you're playing as a leader here. This is a really concerning and sad story, and we really need to see a resolution to it. Appreciate everything you're doing.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your interest in it, and God bless you for what you guys do there, Tony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Kerry Cheshire with Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. Your state lawmaker probably campaigned as a conservative, as someone who would go to Austin to cut spending and limit government. But did he keep that promise? At index.empowertexans.com, you can see how your lawmaker voted on the major issues of the legislative session. Things like property tax relief, the state budget, and regulatory reform. You can also view his score on the Fiscal Responsibility Index and decide if he needs a pat on the back, a wag of the finger, or perhaps a permanent vacation from public service. The Fiscal Responsibility Index is the premier tool for taxpayers to hold their lawmakers accountable. Check us out today at index.empowertexans.com.
Instead of lowering costs, the University of Texas recently announced they are going to give special privileges to certain students. We have Empower Texans intern and college student Jordan Clements to talk about that in this week's commentary.
With tuition exploding out of control by their own hands, the University of Texas recently decided to alleviate the financial burden, but only for a privileged few, including illegal aliens. I'm Jordan Clements with this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary. As a Longhorn, I'm frustrated by UT's new policy, a policy designed to help the few at the expense of the many. The UT Board of Regents decided this summer they will give a tuition-free education to the less than 25% of the student body whose parents make less than $65,000 a year, while providing some help to an even fewer amount of students whose parents make between $65,000 to $125,000 a year. Meanwhile, the students with parents who make too much money will get no relief. With an endowment second only to Harvard University and rampant inefficiencies, studies have shown the university uses less than half of their classrooms at any given time, the UT system has the financial ability to reduce its absurd tuition for every student. After all, it is the duty of a public university to provide a low-cost but quality education to state residents. With $160 million to spare, the UT Board of Regents unanimously declared they will help, but only a select few. Worse yet, under the new policy, even illegal aliens are eligible for the new subsidies so long as they have residency and their illegal alien parents make little money. The university has prioritized the financial success of families who broke the law over U.S. citizens and legal immigrants. UT's new program has all the hallmarks of a classic wealth redistribution scheme. The idea is to take from students with wealthier families through high tuition and use those excess fees to pay for the education of classmates whose parents are less well off. But what UT has failed to recognize is our parents' success does not necessarily translate to our own personal financial stability. Just because a student's parents have money does not necessarily mean they suffer any less due to the shackles of high tuition and student loans. Students from large families suffer under this new scheme, as do those whose parents choose, for whatever reason, to not pay for their college education. Our parents' success does not mean we can magically afford college. We are all adults, ultimately responsible for our own finances. While some families pay for the cost of college, most students have to take out student loans to invest in their education. Instead of lowering tuition across the board, UT has decided to pick and choose winners and losers and force some students to pay their way while others get a free ride just because of their family's finances. But the blame doesn't end with just the UT administration or the UT Board of Regents. The ultimate responsibility is with the governor and with the legislature. The governor chose these regents, and the Texas legislatures have failed to do their job to rein in higher education waste and to control public university tuition rates. It's time for our elected officials to tighten the leash and make sure that our public universities stop wasting tuition as well as taxpayer dollars. That's how we can help every student. I'm Jordan Clements, and this has been this week's Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary.
Well, that's all I've got for you. If you want more information, check us out on the web, texasscorecard.com. Other than that, thanks for listening.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.